You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life.
Okay, it's good to be back. How you doing, Patrick?
Yeah, good, man. How are you?
Yeah, all good. I'm excited for today's topic, actually, because it's been an interesting year, to say the least. Today we're going to talk about recessions, fear, and market timing, which is another juicy topic that everyone gets very excited about.
Oh, man. People love this.
I think they love it more than we do.
Oh, I don't know if it's for the same reasons.
No, you're right. So it's been a very disruptive time, and I think people are on edge and a bit more fearful and a bit more anxious than they would be usually. And that's kind of for a good reason. Like, it's a pretty unusual time that we're living through, don't you reckon?
Yeah, well, definitely very unique in our lifetimes. Obviously, recessions and market downturns have happened before. And sorry, we haven't even got the official definition of recession yet out there. I suppose I'm just assuming, and we'll see what actually comes out. But yeah, pandemics happened. The Spanish flu happened, and that was well before our time. And apparently that affected the stock market quite severely as well during that time. Or maybe it didn't. Maybe it was just a coincidence.
Just to let you guys know, part of these shows, we're just winging it. Like, we do have some notes that we're working on, but we also just wing it and see where the conversation goes at the same time. So if it doesn't seem like 100%, you know, thought out and scripted, that's why.
I think we prefer it that way. I think at least some of our audience prefer it that way as well. Yeah, I think podcasts are generally better when they're a bit unscripted. If you want something that's nice and polished, go to YouTube and find someone who's spent a lot of time.
Yeah, watch a presentation or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So today we want to talk a bit about like how we deal with economic downturns in the sense of financial independence, and like what should we do with our investments when, you know, the market's falling and there's a lot of fear around and things like that. And we'll basically cover this topic from the point of view of people on the journey to financial independence, because it is a bit different for people who have already retired, and that kind of deserves its own episode of how they should cope with times like this, because there is a few other things for them to consider, and it's probably a bit too much for us to get into today.
Yeah, definitely. 2020, eh? It's been one hell of a year so far. Probably a year that'll go down in the ages. We've had this great big pandemic thing happen, and it's disrupted the share market. It's disrupted people's work. Yeah, people's lives in general.
I don't think any of us could have imagined what life would be like in 2020 last year.
No.
It's fair to say that this came way out of left field, you know?
Way out of left field. By the time I was on top of us, I was like, oh, fuck, it's here. It's just happening.
No one really saw it coming.
No one at all. Maybe some politicians in China or something saw it coming, but the rest of us didn't.
But I mean, you can't really see something that clearly in advance before it becomes a thing.
No, you're right. If you're talking about before the very first person got infected with coronavirus, no one saw this thing coming.
I mean, there's supposedly, I haven't watched it, but there's supposedly a speech by Bill Gates in the last couple of years that was warning that this kind of thing was a possibility. But that's not the same thing as saying this is coming in 2020, you know?
No.
You can't exactly plan for that in the next 12 months.
No, definitely not. that's the definition of risk, you know? These things come out of nowhere and they throw a spanner in the works and you just have to react to them.
And so even when it becomes a known thing that the coronavirus is a known risk and a possible global pandemic at the time, we still don't know that that's going to eventuate, because it then depends on the actions of millions of people, or even billions of people, of how the whole thing is managed and how bad or how not bad it turns out. Mm. Yeah, even once you know that it's a possibility and it's a real thing, you still can't necessarily know how it's going to turn out at all.
No, not at all. And, you know, you're kind of beholden to the decisions of world leaders as well. Lots of them deal with it very differently. Like, on one end, you have Jacinda Ardern, which just, you know, shut everything down immediately and removed, essentially, is New Zealand completely virus-free for all intents and purposes now?
I think so.
And then, yeah, on the very other end of the spectrum, I think, like, the president of Brazil or something is just completely denying that the virus is even a thing.
Well, some people think it's actually a hoax. They think the whole thing's made up.
Oh, fuck. I just...
Where do you start with those type of people, hey?
I don't know. It's very frustrating. It's terrible. Honestly, it's terrible.
I guess this brings up the first little section, or the first little topic of today, is like, there's always forecasts of recessions. So should we be listening out for those, or how should we approach that type of thing? Because they're always being forecast, you know? Whether it's in the next 12 months or the next 5 years, there's always recession forecasts. So what do you think about those, Pat?
Well, with so much noise, it becomes nonsense, doesn't it? Becomes the boy who cried wolf.
Mm.
It's impossible to listen to recession forecasts and take them seriously, because if you took recession forecasts seriously, you'd never invest, because there's always a recession forecast out there.
You'd probably just be crawled up in the fetal position on your couch, because if you believed everything you read in the media.
I made a blog post. Actually, it was probably the worst timing blog post ever.
Was that about you can't time the market? It was at the top of the market.
Oh, sorry, I had the worst timed blog post ever, followed by the best timed blog post ever. So I think in February, I listed out like last 8 or 10 years of recession forecasts every year in like a nice long blog post. And I was like, so do you really think you can still time the market? And then bang, like a week or two later, like the market took a crash.
I think we talked about, I remember talking about this at the Playing With Fire Sydney thing. Yeah. I think it was a question from the audience, and I said something like, I think the question was like, you know, people say there is a recession coming and all the rest of it. And this was last year.
Yeah.
And I said, like, if you Google it, Australian recession 2011, Australian recession 2012, every year there's articles about it. So you can't know, you know, people have been wrong for a decade or.
And I did Google it, and then I took all of those links and put them in a blog post.
Mm. And so every year you can find them.
Every year you can find multiple. Like, you can almost find them like every 2 months or something. But anyway, that was followed shortly by my best timed blog post ever. I released a blog post about how you can't time the market. And this was like amidst, you know, everyone saying the market's going to fall, don't invest. Like, everyone became the world's best market timer during the coronavirus pandemic. That blog post I released like 2 days from the bottom of the market.
Ah, yeah.
Or even 1 day from the very bottom of the market. Like, I released it on Saturday or Sunday and the bottom of the market was Monday, and then it's gone up from there ever since.
You could make a $1 million newsletter off that call, Pat.
I know, right? But it's like, it's impossible. That's the whole point. It's impossible.
And that's the thing. Like, they write about, they'll write a super thought out article that lists maybe 5 or even 10 risks to the global economy. And they'll do this every year. And then those risks don't eventuate. And there's a weird thing that's like, once a risk becomes well known about, it almost ceases to be a problem because everybody's watching it. It's usually something that people are not aware of and not watching that becomes the real thing that knocks us off the rails a bit, like a pandemic.
Yeah, bloody hell, it's so hard to get your head around. But it's like, just because there are risks and you know about those risks, and even if they eventuate, it doesn't mean it's going to lead to bad stock market returns because they're priced in. It's only the things that you cannot possibly predict that will lead to sort of a change in stock market returns.
And then you get people claiming like, "Ah, oh, see, I knew this was coming. I knew this was coming." But they're like, they're finally right. You know, these people that there's a recession coming, but for the completely the wrong reason. It was not the reason that they said, you know?
No, no. And then in that case, they're not right because everyone knows a recession's coming. Like both you and I know a recession's coming. And we know a stock market downturn is coming. That doesn't mean we're successful in timing the market.
I guess the point there is that there's always a recession coming and there's always things to worry about because there's always risks in the world. Some that we know about, some that we don't know about. And fear sells and the media literally lives off selling fear to people so that we'll click and we'll watch and stuff. They're literally their bread and butter, you know?
Yeah. They make their money off of clicks. Mm. If you click on it, they get some money. And so what's a sane business person going to do? It's like, well, this is what the audience wants. This is clearly what they respond to. This is what makes me money. Let's just go ahead with that. Let's just get the most clicks possible. Yeah. But anyway, it's also just the point of, we were just talking about all this uncertainty, all this fear. It's like, that is literally why you make a return on the stock market. You get what is called the equity risk premium. If there was no uncertainty and no risk, then what you would have is a bank deposit or a bond.
Why should you earn substantially higher returns relative to not investing if there's no risk involved? You know what I mean? Like, there has to be risk involved for you to expect a higher return. You can't just get higher returns for no risk.
That's right. And by definition, when things are most uncertain and most risky is when you'll make the most returns because people bid down the market.
Very counterintuitive.
Yes. So let's get a bit back more on topic.
So did you have something about Murphy's Law you wanted to mention here, Pat?
Oh, yeah, of course. So people often wrongly think that Murphy's Law is stated as if something can go wrong, it will go wrong. But it's actually much more broad than that. It's if something can happen, it will happen. And what that basically means is when you have enough iterations of an event or when the sample size becomes large enough, if anything is even remotely possible, it will happen. So what I like to say about this, and I think I wrote it before, is if you were blindfolded and you were throwing a dart at a dartboard, what are the chances you'll hit the bullseye? Almost nothing. Right? Almost nothing. But if you blindfolded 1 million people and you got them to throw 10 darts at a dartboard, you have 10 million chances of hitting the bullseye. And just by pure chance, some of them, even quite a lot of them, are going to hit the bullseye even while throwing darts blindfolded. And this is how I like to talk about people who predict the next stock market downturn or try and time the market. It's like you have, I think, something like 4 million private investors in Australia, and you have something like 120,000 managed funds. Just by pure chance alone, pure chance, you're going to get a few of those, you know, who are going to hit the bullseye, and they're going to time the market absolutely perfectly, and they're going to come out and think they're geniuses. But statistically, that was going to happen. They're not geniuses.
And the funny part is that I think it's in our human nature to believe or convince ourselves that if we get it right, it was because of our research and intelligence and whatever, nothing to do with luck. But on the downside, if we invested at the worst possible time, I was just unlucky, you know what I
mean? Yeah. And, you know, there's 119,999 active fund managers who are also investing all this time and money and research to get the market timing perfect. And they didn't get it right, but there was just like this one in a million Murphy's Law sort of thing. They got it right and they're some guru, some genius market timer.
Yeah, so you'll find a couple of investors, a couple of, I guess, economists and forecasters who might have a few good predictions that come true. But like you say, that's just as likely down to chance alone due to the volume of people making predictions.
Yeah, correct. And you just have to really get your head around the sheer volume here. Millions and millions of people are making these predictions. Some of them are going to be correct. And I think I really got to know this sort of concept really well from work. So for people who don't know, I work generally on the railways in Sydney, maintaining and upgrading the railways. So I've worked public sector and private sector in pretty much that same role. And I think at one point in time, there was like a whole bunch of train delays during peak hour one morning. and the root cause of those train delays was someone flicked a bottle cap onto the railway, and the bottle cap sat perfectly between like a bolt and a rail, and it shorted out the circuit that controls the signals.
Oh, wow.
The signals for that particular turnout. And this, the chances of this happening were so outlandishly small. But when you have like hundreds of people flicking crap onto the railways every day, like just throwing it off the platform, throwing it over the fence, and you have like trains running like millions of passengers every week, this is sort of the challenge of the railways, I suppose. But it's the same concept. It's like, if anything is even remotely possible, if you increase the volume of the sample size, it'll eventually happen.
At some point, it is bound to happen. Yeah.
At some point, it is bound to happen. And it was crazy.
That's an interesting example.
Yeah, and sure, there's a whole lot of people listening to this who won't even believe me that happened. But that actually did happen. It's so frustrating, because how do you economically stop that sort of thing from happening? Like, you can't go around spending billions and billions of dollars, you know, upgrading the fences to solid screens off all the platforms and all the railways. But people still blame sort of what is actually a pretty competent railway system when something like that happens. And it's like, well, what do you do?
I guess you just have to accept that there's some level of risk and unknowable circumstances or unknowable outcomes involved in everything, really.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
What are we trying to say here? I guess we're trying to say that, you know, economic downturns and recessions are going to be an inevitable part of our lives, really, and a normal part of an economy and investing. So we need to expect them and prepare for them by being in good financial shape, you know, in our personal lives. After 10 years of good returns and nearly 30 years of economic growth in Australia, it's definitely not always sunshine and rainbows. You know, we're not entitled to this perpetually growing, never slowing or whatever machine that just chugs along forever.
That's right. So this brings us to market timing. So people often believe that they can sell out of a market that's high and then buy back in when it's low. You know, the old saying, buy high, sell low. And it sounds so reasonable. It's like, yeah, of course, buy when the market's high, sell when it's low.
No, the other way around.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
What kind of advice are you giving people, Pat?
Sell high, buy low. Yeah, of course. Oh, there you go. This is why I've been failing all this time.
You got no right to have a blog, mate.
No.
You just disqualified yourself.
Yeah, disqualified. It's all over, guys. Ah, God, I could have been retired 10 years ago, but I've been doing it wrong this whole time. But, okay, so what's wrong with trying to time the market in that way? Well, the question is, how do you know when it's high and how do you know when it's low?
Well, it's a perfect idea, right? Why don't we just buy when it's low and then just ride it on the way up and then sell when it's high and wait till it falls and then get back in and do the same thing and just repeat that over and over again. Why not? Sounds like a good idea to me.
Mate, it's the perfect investment strategy.
Would you say that it sounds almost too good to be true?
I think I would say it sounds too good to be true. Because if it were so easy, then everyone would do it. And then there would be no more market risk. And then the market completely breaks down because it's not a free cash-making machine. Why can't we do this? Well, first of all, how are you going to time the market? Are you going to try and listen to the news? Are you going to try and listen to market forecasters and look up articles on how the economy is doing?
I think we've just explained why that's complete nonsense.
That's right.
But why is it nonsense? Why can't we do this? Why is it not possible to repeat this kind of stuff?
I suppose the main message here is, if you're reading it in the news, then everyone already knows it and the market's already adjusted to take into account the news.
Because everyone's reading the same news, basically. So if you read the news and come away with, I think the market's definitely set to fall, you know, based on this and this and this. So everyone else probably is reading the same thing you are, and probably, you know, if things are starting to look bad, prices will count for that by being lower because the future no longer looks as good as it did before.
Yep. That's right.
So there's kind of a conundrum there, whereas when things start looking bad is when the market, not when things are bad, but when things start looking bad, or like the future is not quite as bright as it was before, that's when the market starts to fall to account for those less rosy future earnings, I suppose we'll call it.
Yeah, precisely. You also have to remember here that you with your iPhone 10 or your laptop at home with an NBN connection, you're basically the turtle in this race. You have zero chance of being able to get to that news quicker and make those decisions quicker than professional fund managers. They have extraordinary computing power. They have extraordinary internet speeds. They have done an extraordinary amount of research. I think some fiber cable was laid across the ocean between America and England for the specific reason of knocking like 12 milliseconds off the speed of transfer between those locations so that traders could trade quicker between those markets. And you're never going to be able to beat that sort of money and effort and time and research being spent into that. And we're also talking about people here who have like doctorate degrees and 10, 15 years of experience and do this 8, 10, 12 hours every single day. And they've done that for 10, 20, 30 years. It's impossible. You just can't beat those sorts of people at market timing.
So if we read a news article and we start feeling, you know, nervous, like, oh, I think there's going to be a recession, it's already way, way too late to kind of, oh, I think the market's going to go down. Maybe I'll sell now and I'll buy back in later.
Yeah, it's extraordinarily late and the market's already priced it in. And so you're already sitting at the valuation you should be sitting at.
I mean, we've both written about this before because it comes up again and again and again. Mm-hmm. But one point is that people think, well, if a recession is coming in the future, when the recession is announced, that's when the market will fall because people will panic, you know, and all the rest of it. But the point here is that the market falls before there is a recession. And there's been studies done on this because it's quite obvious that a recession is coming because all the economic data and the economic data that's coming out no longer looks as good as it did before. It kind of looks like things are about to dip. So that's why a recession starts being priced in. When it's announced, it's already too late.
Oh, man. I think the share market is actually a really good predictor of a recession, not the other way around. It's like several months ahead, the share market already knows it's coming.
And so counterintuitively, studies show that markets actually fall before there is a recession. And when the recession is actually taking place, the market rises because the future is starting to, there's green shoots, you know, and the future is starting to look better. Yep. And so the market is pricing in that slightly better future earnings or whatever while we're actually in recession. Because if you're already in recession, the future has to be better than, you know, what's happening right now.
Well, the thing is, a recession is never announced in real time. So
it's way delayed.
Well, the thing is, like, a bunch of, I don't know who actually announces it. Like, I think it's, do you know who announces recessions? Anyway, it's not important.
Well, I think the Bureau of Statistics and the RBA both do their own kind of data sets and stuff like that. And then it gets announced by whoever, I don't know. I mean, like Josh Frydenberg, the Treasurer, announced it early because he knew it was coming because of the data and Corona and that. So it can get announced like that if it's super obvious.
Well, but the thing is, you don't know a recession has happened until months after it started. It's like when they get together and they announce a recession, they're not saying, oh, today's a recession. They're saying, you know, it's like June or something. And it's like, yes, we entered a recession on January 23rd, 2020. And by the time they announced that the recession started, the recession might have already ended. Yeah. And they won't know that until the economic data comes out. And
3 months later.
Yeah, a few quarters of continued growth. And then like in 2021 on February 27, it's like, yep, the recession ended on July 13th. You know, 2020. And it's like, okay, sweet. That was not useful to a market timer whatsoever.
Yeah, not at all, man. That's one of those counterintuitive ideas that's hard to square in your head at first. But once you kind of understand, it makes more sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for the everyday person using things like that and news, and it's just not helpful at all to try and figure this stuff out. And try and time the market that way.
Yeah.
But then we get the conversation of, but what about when markets are expensive and markets look overvalued? Is it not sensible then to invest at times when markets are cheaper, or to maybe sell out some of your holdings when markets are expensive. That's when this conversation comes along. Like, well, okay, I can't time the market most of the time, and recessions are, you know, not helpful in deciding when the best time is to invest. But what about when markets are expensive? What should we do?
Well, how do you know that they're expensive? Is probably the first question.
People like to bring out, well, the one of the most common metrics that people use is just the price to earnings ratio, which basically tells us, for a given, when we're purchasing shares, how many dollars of earnings is that actually, are we actually purchasing with our investment. If the price to earnings ratio is like 20, that means you're purchasing $5 of earnings for every $100 that you're investing. And so if the price to earnings ratio is 10, you're purchasing $10 of earnings for your $100 investment. So logically, people would prefer to invest when the price to earnings ratio is lower than higher. Obviously.
Obviously, that makes the most sense. Except, like, again, everyone has access to this this metric. They're all using it to price it. And it's sort of a metric that's in a bubble, when you can't just place that metric in a bubble. Like, you have to consider everything else. You have to consider where other people can invest their money, where else, you know, how that compares to the share market. Like you said, it's price and earnings. So price over earnings gives you this ratio. People think that, oh, if the price to earnings is high, then the market has to crash to bring price to earnings back to a reasonable level. But that might not happen at all. All that might happen is you wait 5 years until earnings kind of catches up and it grows and grows and grows while the price doesn't move. And then it just continues.
And that's also assuming that the price to earnings ratio, that the long-term average, will stay the same forever. That's assuming that the next 50 years looks like the last 100 years, and the price to earnings ratio might be an average of 15 or something like that. So people think, oh, well, now it's 18, so it means the market is way overvalued, so I should wait.
Yeah, which is, of course, nonsense, because there's no reason to believe that the next 100 years will be the same as the last 100 years in terms of stock market.
So many things can change over that kind of time frame. You know, interest rates, very high interest rates, very low interest rates, all of these things have a bearing on what a sensible price to pay for shares is relative to other assets.
Just again, look at the risk story. It's like, shares now might not be as risky as they were in the last 100 years. Like, now there might be a better accounting standards, now there might be better like governmental control of the economy, and so they've learned their lessons of the past, and so the market might just be pricing in the fact that the market's less risky, so you're going to get a lower return into the future, and hence there'll be a higher PE going forward. I'm not saying that's actually the case. I'm just saying that's a plausible thing that's happening now. So you can't really look at something like the CAPE or the PE and say, well, now it must be overvalued.
Because we're just assuming that the future is exactly the same as the past, which is, I don't think that's a fair argument at all.
No.
There's other things that come into it as well. Like, there's never been a time in history like now where investors can invest in basically zero cost funds and get exactly the market return. You know, like 50, 70 years ago, you'd have to invest in a very expensive, typically managed fund, which even if it kept up with the market, was going to cost you like 1, maybe 2% per year. So that means that investors are actually earning higher net returns today. So maybe that could warrant a higher price to earnings ratio as well.
Yeah, and the market is so efficient. Like, it immediately arbitrages all the improvements that are made. Like you said, now that there's much better access to the market, and it's, you can get very cheap access and very dependable, the distribution of outcomes is now more dependable because of index funds. The market's gonna now arbitrage that as a lower risk, and then hence take some of the return out.
That's even before we get to the fact that we have the lowest interest rates in history, which act to make every other asset class more attractive than cash and bonds. And it's nowhere near as simple as just saying, oh, well, the PE is expensive, or the CAPE is high, so we can't invest, or it's way overvalued. It's just not that high. And that's not to say that valuation doesn't matter at all, but that it's just not as simple, and you shouldn't worship one metric that's like, well, it looks a bit iffy to me. So that's just assuming that you know exactly how the future is going to play out, which is ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
But, you know, people have that conversation where it's like, if you're saying the market's not overvalued, overvalued, or simply that you don't know and you're continuing to invest anyway, that you're somehow super reckless and you don't care about valuation and you don't care about your returns and all the rest of it. They push it to its extreme and say, well, you know.
People love the whole, oh, well, Warren Buffett is a value investor and he looks at the businesses and the valuations and therefore that's what I'm going to do. And it's like, it sounds so sexy. It does. It sounds so reasonable. It sounds so, you know, sober. Unfortunately, that's, again, not looking at the bigger picture, like looking at, you know, market efficiency and just accepting how you really can't know these things any better than anyone else. Because that's the sort of, I think, the missing link that a lot of people fail to make. It doesn't matter how well you know things. It matters how much better you know them than anyone else in the market. Or everyone else. And the answer is you don't know them better than everyone else in the market. You can't possibly.
And then you're just making bets on your vision of the future, of what you think, nope, the price has to come back down to this level. That's a sensible level.
Yeah.
How do you know? You don't know. You can't know.
You can't possibly know.
But this brings up the next topic. We've all heard of people who can or who think they can time the market. Like, who knows what's coming next? You know, the famous anecdotes and stories that people tell and the average Aussie punter giving their view.
Yeah, they love it. They love it. It's every time someone makes a great bet, they come out of the woodwork and they just tell you about how they made that great bet. It's like everyone knows that person who's gone to the pokies and they've had a good win and they come and they show you their winnings and like, see, look, I was just tapping for only, I swear I only put $10 on and I won $500.
They don't tell you about the $700 they lost in the last 3 months.
No. It's always a positive story. And these anecdotes come out all the time. It's absolute nonsense. I can't stand it. It drives me nuts because it's so disingenuous.
So then there's people throw out examples, you know, about the stock market. You know, look at Tesla, look at Afterpay. The market is definitely in a bubble because you have stocks that are acting like they're in a bubble. You know, so they translate that across to, well, look at this type of behavior. That means the market is very frothy, you know, and very risky right now. What do you think about that?
Just very self-indulgent, don't you think? It's like
self-indulgent in what way?
I can see what's happening. I know.
Ah, there's like an air of intelligence that they're above everyone else.
I'll say it's the height of arrogance. It's, you know, you're not part of the majority. All of the reports, all of the research, all of the, even like the proper expert, even Warren Buffett, people who love to refer to Warren Buffett, even he says, oh, just put it in an index fund. You can't do better.
And he says, I don't know what's going to happen in the market in the next couple of years even.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone accepts that the majority can't beat the market, but they think they're part of that 0.0. 0.01% who can beat the market.
But I'm special. Like, but I'm special, Pat. I do my research.
I suppose we're not using emotive enough language. When we say majority, we're not talking like 60-40. We're not even talking 20-80. We're not even talking like 5% of, you know, 95% people can't beat. We're talking like 99.9999% of people are part of the majority and can't beat the market. There's like this disappearingly small number of people who are really good and they can actually do it. And have to accept, you just have to repeat to yourself, like, I can't beat the market. I can't beat the market.
I guess part of it's just learning to approach investing in general with a bit of humility.
Yeah.
To just step back and I guess be honest with yourself and say, look, I really don't know more than everyone else. How could I know more than people who do this for a living? So my efforts are probably not going to be rewarded at all.
No.
But then people like to drag out examples of, you know, the market can't be efficient because look, we have, if you invested at this top point of the market 2000 or 2008 and all the rest of it, you would have made X return, usually like a crap return from this date to this date. Yeah. You know what I mean? So clearly you shouldn't invest when the market is high. The key point that they're missing there is that investing is not like a one-time event. It's not like you invest all your money on this date and you take it out at this date. It's not even close to that. You're investing every month for years and years and years. So some of the money you will invest will be when the market ends up being at a high point, and plenty of it will be at a low point. And because you're investing regularly, you end up getting the average of those outcomes. So you'll be doing this for 10, 15 years. So to look at one start and end date is just absolutely dumb. I mean, it might be interesting, but it's just dumb. You're not going to invest like that. How is that relevant to you and your journey?
It's very, very rare that people invest in one go in their entire lump sum in a single transaction.
Well, especially the people that we're talking to here, Pat, like people who are building up a portfolio over time to eventually live off in the future. So looking at these start and end dates is not helpful at all.
No. Definitely not.
I feel like I'm the one doing the ranting today.
No, that's all right. We're both ranting. We're feeding off each other.
Feeding off the fury.
So how do we deal with the fear and uncertainty around investing? So I suppose you just have to remind yourself that the market isn't going to zero. And if you're invested in broad market index funds globally and in Australia, chances are, you know, the market will still be here in 50 years' time. And if it isn't here in 50 years' time, then you've got greater things to worry about than your share market investments.
Mm.
Probably need, I think, rifles and baked beans and a bomb shelter.
I think that's a good point too for people to remember. Like, we need to remind ourselves that we're investing in a huge group of productive businesses, and they're just not going to go to zero, you know. A couple will, that's inevitable. They'll fall out of the top 200 or whatever. That happens, you know, on a regular basis. But if you're investing in a massive group of companies, it's just not feasible that in 50 years' time, they're not going to be there and they won't be worth, you know, more than they are today.
Well, the same companies might not be there, but the index will still be there. And you will automatically own those companies that have been moved into the index. So no point looking at individual companies when you're an index investor.
Also, we can look at past downturns and market falls, and that can help us when the market is falling. We often get a bit worried, like, well, it's falling, so I'll just wait until it's going back up, you know what I mean? But as we've said, like, it's just not that simple at all. And I guess the point here is that if you look at a chart, a long-term share market chart over like 50 years, which points would you prefer to invest at? You probably prefer to invest at the earliest points and at the lowest points. So if the market is falling, you can take some solace in the fact that it's at a lower point than it was before. And you'll probably think the same in the future when you look back on times. You'll wish you had invested at the lower points when the market was falling.
Yeah. Precisely. Because investing in ETFs is so abstract, the price of the ETF fluctuates so much. I don't know, people treat it differently than how they would treat anything else. So apologies for being just a bit rudimentary here. But if you literally could buy a goose that laid a golden egg, this is exactly the same thing.
I didn't see that coming. If you could buy a goose...
Would you prefer to buy the goose at $100 or $50? When the value of when the value of geese drops from $100 to $50, do you worry that you've already bought two geese at $100, or do you just buy another two at $50? And then the geese give you your golden eggs?
Especially if you have regular savings, which you're building up a portfolio of geese.
No, exactly. But because it's so abstract, people worry when their ETFs or their geese drop from $100 to $50. They're like, oh, now I only have $100 worth of geese in, you know, whatever. I only have $1,000 worth of geese, whereas last week I had $2,000 worth of geese. It's like, don't worry. The golden eggs are still coming. Just buy more geese.
So what's the ticker code for this geese ETF?
Oh, we're going to start something here.
So another thing I like to do, and another thing that I think of that is helpful for people and what I find useful, is to look at the dividends that companies produce over time. I mean, like in a downturn, the dividends will fall as well, but it does help to remind people that it's not all about share prices and squiggly lines on a chart. You know, these are real businesses, and they're still out there and they're still making real cash. You know, they haven't disappeared because the market's falling. They're not all going bankrupt just because their share price is falling. They're still out there making money for shareholders. So I find that focusing on that little stream of cash flow that you get from your investments definitely helps to stay focused, like, on the actual fundamentals of what's happening behind the scenes, and remove yourself from the charts and the noise and all that sort of crap.
Yeah, remove yourself from the worry of it, really, from the emotion. That brings us to our next point. Just don't look at it. Like, if you want to sort of shield yourself from your own emotions and the craziness, and there's no sensible reason to be looking at your share portfolio daily.
What can you do about it? Like, it's madness.
You can sell it all. You can sell it all at the top and then buy back at the bottom.
One of the interesting points here is that, correct me if I'm wrong, but psychologists and that have found that we experience pain, I think, is it two or three times more strongly, the pain of loss, two or three times more strongly than the joy of gain. So even if you check your portfolio every day, one time it's up and one time it's down, that doesn't equal out. You will experience more pain than you will joy. Because when it's up, you look at it and go, oh, that's good. When it's down, you're like, oh, no, damn. You know, there's more of a stronger emotion that brings. So the less you can look at your portfolio, the better. Because as the market goes up more years than it goes down, and as it goes up over time on average, the less you look at it, the higher chance there is that it was higher than before, than the last time you looked at it, you know?
And this goes back to that. I think in a previous podcast, we mentioned that Morningstar report where the most successful investors were dead investors. And it's like, just people who don't look and don't fiddle end up being the most successful. Mm. They get the market return, and at the end of it, they have the most money, even if they're dead. But
so just ignore it and continue on with your plan exactly as you had before, because nothing has really changed. You know, you're building this portfolio to live off someday. So just keep building it. Like, don't worry. Don't second guess yourself. Just keep focused on your main goal and your main job.
But you know what's funny? People get worried when it's going down, and then people get worried again when it's going up.
Because it's going to go down soon.
Yeah, it's like, it happened. It happened this year. It's like when it was in March. It's like, oh, it's going to keep going down. It's bad. You know, recession's coming. And then it's going up. It's like, oh, it's detached from the economy and fundamentals. Yeah, it can't be this high. It's going to crash soon. And it's like, oh, fuck. It's never.
I had this in a post not too long ago where some people, you can either focus on the positives all the time or you can focus on the negatives all the time in the share market. Like, there's something for everyone. So the thing was, when the market's rising, oh, this sucks, you know, the market's rising, it's going to fall soon, it's overvalued. It's
getting expensive.
Yeah.
Expensive.
And then when it's falling, oh no, I'm losing money, this is crap, why am I investing? You know, like, you're miserable the whole time. And when it's going nowhere, it's like, oh, this is boring, nothing's happening, I'm not making any money. So you can be permanently miserable if you like.
You're right. Or you can be permanently happy. It's like, oh, sweet, my value of my portfolio is going up. It's like, awesome. It's like, oh, great. Now the stock market's crashing. I can buy more, even cheaper.
And if it's going nowhere, you're like, oh, well, I'll just sit back and receive my dividends and you know, continue to buy shares anyway.
Exactly.
So there's something for everyone.
Yes. No matter which way you're inclined.
But if we are experiencing a recession or a market fall, the best thing really to do is buy more if you can, just to continue investing as you planned before, because any delay or guesswork about the future and what's going to happen, you start playing this market timing game and you'll get yourself into knots about, well, if you don't invest now, when do you invest? And it's just going to give you a giant headache, and you're just going to be mentally exhausted. You're going to be spinning your wheels. And as we've said, it typically leaves you worse off.
So I suppose if people are building their portfolio long term, say over decades, these small variations don't matter. And if anything, you want to be buying as much as you can when markets are down. But that'll happen automatically anyway, because the price is cheaper. If you're investing a set amount per week, per month, per quarter, you'll end up buying more shares at the cheaper price than you buy at the more expensive price.
Exactly. And that's kind of the magic, I guess, of, if we can use that word, of dollar cost averaging, where you're, it's just no effort required, where you're scooping up a higher number of shares with the same amount of savings each month because the market price is lower than before.
Yeah, precisely. And by maintaining your diversification across multiple different markets, so across the world, ideally, you sort of remove a lot of the risk. Not all of it, of course, but what happens to Australia, if Australia goes into recession, you can rely on your global share portfolio to continue producing results for you. Or if the whole world goes in recession, then you just have to ride that out. You can't diversify that away. But the magic of a diversification is you can always have, you know, if you have multiple horses in the race, or you have all the, you're backing all the horses.
What about the geese?
Oh, all the geese. The geese don't usually race, do they? They're the ones running. If you're backing, you know, if you have money on all the horses, then at some point in time, each one of those horses will be in the lead, and you can draw upon that part of the portfolio.
And I guess even though you might be investing in a passive type of strategy, you are making an active bet that the Australian economy and that the global economy and companies broadly will be more profitable in the future than they are currently. So you're making that bet. So just remember to focus on the bigger picture here.
Yes, and like we said before, unless you think society is going to completely collapse, at which point, who cares about your investments? Like, so just in summary of the main points of this whole market timing thing, which we feel very strongly about, it never feels like a perfect time to invest. There are always risks, there are always negative stories, there's always stuff to worry about. Every time is scary, every recession is scary, it's always different. You just have to accept that that's what it's always going to feel like, and you just have to keep investing.
That's what you're getting paid for too, remember, to take risk. That's right. Uncertainty is what you're getting paid for.
It's the equity risk premium. So it's when it's most uncertain is when you have the best chance of making the most money, especially if you're broadly diversified, like we advocate. You can't reach FI or financial independence just by waiting and hoping or waiting for the best time to get in the market. It ain't going to happen. There'd never be a good time.
If you do that, it makes your investing, you'll be forever anxious and second guessing what you're doing. And it makes your investing more emotion driven rather than process driven, of that consistent investing every month, like you said just before, Pat. You want to make it like a simple automatic habit that's just happening in the background, and not to think about it too much.
The joy of making it just a regular habit. I can't tell everyone enough just how much less stressful it is to choose one day every month and just buy on that day and just do that as a habit. And just continue to do that every time. It removes all the anxiety, all the stress. Even if you're sort of a disciplined, regular investor, just the process of just doing it on the exact same day every month, like the first Tuesday of every month, or whatever, it makes it easier. It really reduces any sort of anxiety or stress you might have, because it's like, well, that's what's happening. It's not going to change. Whatever the price is that day, that's what I'm buying. So I don't even think about it.
And as we covered, timing the market is impossibly difficult. And for almost everyone, almost all of the time, it's just not going to happen. And the market tends to make a big fool out of people who think they are smart. So it tends to approach investing and even the world and investing and markets with a bit of humility, because we really don't know the future. We can't.
Well, who was that fella in The Big Short who supposedly timed the GFC? Was it Mike Burberry? Am I saying that?
Michael Burry
or something.
Yeah, so that's right.
Just keep in mind, you're not going to be the next Michael Burry. Like, you just, you might think you're being really smart and intelligent, but 99.999%, that ain't going to happen. You're just going to be made a fool of. Don't even try it.
And remember that scary times are typically a great time to invest, and also a great time to work on your personal finances and make sure that, I guess, your situation is optimized and you've got a healthy savings rate to help you take advantage of times like that. And even if you can find more cash and more ways to increase your savings, that'll just strengthen your position even more.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's the end of our market timing pod, Dave. What do you think?
I think that's about it, man. I think we've ranted enough on that topic for today.
We could probably keep going for another hour, but hopefully we don't want to repeat ourselves too much.
Yeah. All right, so should we get into our listener question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, today's question is, love the podcast, guys, and the fact that you talk openly and also cover the qualitative challenges and benefits of FIRE as well. I think discussing cash flow management would be helpful. So how do you guys do it? Do you use any tools or apps, etc., like Pocketbook? You want to go first, Pat?
Yeah, okay. So the answer is no, I don't really use any tools or any apps. I just kind of spend however I want through the year, and then I sort of track it. Definitely at the end of the year, sometimes I do it interim as well. I'll do it at 6 months or 3 months just to see how I'm going. But I never seem to spend all that much. And I suppose that just comes down to I've taken care of my big expenses. I've sort of reduced my recurring expenses as far as I feel is reasonable. And I just tackle every purchase consciously, I'll say. I kind of take it from first principles. It's like, okay, do I really want to buy this? Do I not want to buy this? Is this going to bring value to my life? In the back of my mind, that process happens in a second. Like, is this worth, even though I'm explaining it out here and verbalizing it during this podcast, it's not a process that takes a long time at all when you're at the shops or whatever.
You're not sitting at the shop with this item for 10 minutes staring at it like, oh, what should I do?
Yeah, is this, I haven't got a checklist or anything that I'm checking.
Pros and cons.
Here yeah, no. This process happens in a couple of seconds at most. And it's like, but that's every purchase. I don't willy-nilly bring things into my life that I don't think are going to add value to my life. And at the end of the year, that generally results in a spend that's very low. I'll call it effortless because I still buy things that I think are valuable. Like I bring these examples up all the time. Like I still go out with my friends when it seems appropriate. I still spend money on things we need around the apartment. But I'm just not spending it on nonsense. At the end of a year, that generally results in a spend of about $25,000 for me, maybe the same again for Steph. So as a couple, we're $40,000 to $50,000, including rent. So that's how I do it. That's how I tackle it. I just approach every purchase with the same mindset, and it always turns out not bad for me. And it's also a very low stress way to do it for someone who's maybe a bit more advanced.
Yeah. I feel pretty much the same. I follow almost exactly the same approach as you. I mean, we don't really follow, we don't follow a budget. Never really been a budget type of person. I've never been a spreadsheet type of person. I used to actually just have like a pen and paper estimate, like when we were saving, and be like, because I roughly know what our expenses were, and I just used to have a written estimate. Yeah. But now, like, it's only since I started the blog that I actually tracked the dollar amounts, just so I had like some
content
proof for myself and then to put it in, categorize everything and do it properly. So I've only just started that now. And the way I do it is I just have a very simple spreadsheet that I log onto my bank once a week, and I just, whatever transactions are in there for the last 7 days, I just add the dollar amounts to those categories, and that's it. Takes me all of about 3 minutes a week or something like that.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of, yeah, it's there at the end of the year for me to have a look at. Yeah, we don't follow a budget or a bucket approach. I don't really like the bucket approach. That's pretty popular.
Yeah, different approaches work for different people. But I think you and I, as we said last week, we're pretty odd. You know, we're not normal.
Yeah.
That definitely works for us. I can kind of see the value if you have come from a past where you had high spending habits, where it could be useful to track what you're spending and trying to make sure that it's not going anywhere kind of terrible. But after several years of building strong spending habits and then just loosely tracking it to make sure that it's not veering off path, I find it's very easy to not need to have a very scrutinizing eye on your spending.
And I find it more, I don't know, it seems, I kind of feel like it's more healthy to have an approach where you're not forced to stick to a certain dollar amount for each category, or you're not forced to, okay, this is our holiday money, so that's how much we have to spend on holidays. Like, I prefer, like, even if you need those things at the start to kind of get you on the right track, after you kind of progress a bit with and improve your habits that way, I kind of think it's a good idea to make it more of a values-based decision at the time on
on each purchase.
Yeah, just questioning each purchase. And that's essentially what we do. Like, is this worth it or is this not worth it? Once you've built those healthy habits already, I think it's better to move to that type of approach rather than a forced budget.
Yeah, I've never liked forced budgets because it doesn't capture the nuance in people's lives. Because saying I'm going to spend exactly this much on socializing or exactly this much on my holiday fund. But, you know, in reality, this year you might spend a bit more on holidays. This next year you might spend a little more on socializing and homecation. I don't know.
Staycation.
type stuff. And it's just a bit more flexible and, like you said, a bit more value-based. If you are coming from a position where you have no idea what you're spending and you do need to sort of rein that in, then to begin with, I can see the value in just tracking what you're doing.
Agreed. All right, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave us a review or even share it with a friend. And if you have a question that you'd like us to answer on the show, you can email us at fireandchillpod@gmail.com. You'll find more from us at our blogs, strongmoneyaustralia.com and lifelongshuffle.com. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.